There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Monday, November the 25th. All this week, Dubai is hosting the Big Five event. It is the construction industry gathering. We've been speaking to the managing director of the engineering consultancy, Mott MacDonald, who gave us an overview of the Dubai construction industry. What's the good news as we enter this event?
I think one of the things that, particularly from the UAE's perspective, we need to remember, it's led construction volumes probably for the last 4 to 5 years. And I think one of the things we're seeing now, whilst there are problems in the market around, certainly around the supply of real estate, what we're really seeing is a maturity of both the cities of Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And with that maturity, you start getting less asset creation and the market gets into more asset management. You can't keep building forever, and there is a limit, and that limit is starting to be reached, certainly in terms of the demographic and the resources that are needed to run this region. I think in the next year, it's certainly going to be reduced volumes, and some of the data from Mead shows that. It looks like it's going to be stable, but it's going to be at a lower level, and I think that's something that we've all got to come to terms with.
I mean, that Mead says $63 billion worth of projects last year, down from more than $100 billion just 5 years ago in 2014. Are we going to stay around that kind of 60-ish billion level?
Just about, and maybe a little lower. A lot of that was due to completions. There's a lot of work being completed now, certainly in Dubai, but there's also some starts in Abu Dhabi. So as ever, it tends to be the tale of two cities. Dubai is certainly a reducing market from a construction perspective. There are very few new starts now. But Abu Dhabi, there is still some work taking place in around national housing programs and also the oil industry. I think that the other parts of the region, there is certainly a little bit more growth. And I think the same data that Mead quoted from a regional perspective, actually the volumes are around about the same year on year, but certainly the UAE is going to be reduced, yeah.
Sheikh Mohammed's stated aim is to have 25 to 30% of buildings sort of 3D printed by 2030. How does that affect the traditional industry, the sort of people that might be displaying at the Big Five?
It affects it a lot, and I think this is one of the things we're going to be seeing at the Big Five. Really what has come to be known as future tech is really the use of technology in the delivery of construction on site, and one of those is around 3D printing. Now, from that perspective, the sophistication has increased a lot in the last 4 years. To start with, to print a 3D building, you pretty much had to have a rig that was bigger than the building itself. And really, in a traditional way, you might see a 3D printer on somebody's desk. You printed the building inside it. The most recent example, that's at Warsaw, and actually used more like a robotic arm to actually create the building. That shows more sophistication, and it also shows a lot more efficiency. I think that what we need to realise is by 2030, not all buildings or that percentage of buildings won't be created by robotics. However, the componentry, there will be a large increase in the use of 3D printing for the componentry that makes up buildings. What, it's not possible to build a tower, for example, using 3D printing on its own.
What defines that? Because you're saying you need something that will pour plastic in to a mould effectively, which is what those cement pumpers do with the big sort of soft nozzles on the end. Isn't that 3D printing then, by that definition?
That's a really good example. I think what the way that the buildings are built is use a composite material that's not unlike concrete, and it basically squeezes it out a bit like toothpaste, if you like, around layer upon layer, building it up. Now that is very different from just pumping concrete into molds, effectively molds around the construction in a more traditional way on slabs and beams. That's the way we build at the moment and have been doing for many years. With 3D printing, the robotic arm is actually programmed to create the building around a pre-prescribed shape. And it removes a lot of manpower, so 30 or 40% less manpower to actually build buildings using 3D printing. As I say, that's unlikely to be in a large scale the future. We're more likely to see 3D printing of componentry of buildings, elements of buildings that can then be put together on site.
So what does this mean for the big traditional construction companies here in the Middle East? We think of the likes of Arabtech because it's a listed company, but many, many others as well. We read from Mead that margins are already being squeezed. If there's a rise of 3D printing, of modular construction, of off-site manufacturing, which you say we're seeing more of, where does that leave the Arabtechs of this world?
I think this is in a significant state of change, and I think this is one of the biggest challenges that the industry has got. What it needs to do is to be able to actually invest in that new technology and also training to enable the construction to be implemented in that way. What we're seeing is the rise of the design and assembly company where they actually design the 3D componentry and also create off-site modules that then can be assembled actually on site. Now, this is very different from a much more traditional way of developing, which has been really the panacea in not just the UAE, but the Middle East, where we very much see cast in situ concrete. In other words, the concrete actually poured on site. That's going to change, and it has done in the rest of the world as well. So the technology is out there. The expertise is out there. It's requiring the Middle East to really upscale its way of creating building assets.
Chris Seymour is Managing Director of Mott MacDonald Middle East. He's one of the speakers at the Big Five event. Chris, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Rock, roll and not insignificant amounts of concrete as well. The Big Five event opens its doors. It is one of the region's, if not the world's, biggest events for the construction industry. 68,000 people, they reckon, are going to be down there at the Dubai World Trade Centre. One of them is Chris Seymour. He is the Managing Director of the engineering consultancy Mott MacDonald in the Middle East. We've been speaking to Chris and we asked him to summarise the state of the construction industry here in the Middle East and the UAE as we head into 2020 in terms of the good, the bad and the ugly.
The good part about the UAE construction industry, I think, is that we're probably going to see a fairly stable year next year, but that's going to be on reduced volumes. And I think that that's one of the problems that maybe the construction industry has got to come to terms with. In the UAE, we're really going from a position of asset creation to more asset management. And this is just an adjustment that we really see in maturing markets. And I think really, from the UAE's perspective, that's what we're going to start seeing. I think in terms of the ugly side of it, I think that payment is still sometimes a problem out there. But I think that that's also something that we're starting to see that improve, although there's still more work to do. I think the way that the market is buying construction needs to get more sophisticated. And I think if that is undertaken, then we should get more investment in training and technology.
We've been speaking, as well as to builders and engineers, to some of the architects who designed some of the iconic buildings around Dubai, including Brian Johnson. He's the Johnson in Godwin Austin Johnson, which is one of the UAE's biggest and oldest architecture firms. He's the guy who designed the Dubai Creek Golf Club, which you will see on the back of a 20 dirham note if you're lucky enough to have one in your wallet. And we asked him, not about his own architecture, but his views on Dubai's iconic architecture. And we really like the definition of iconic architecture that Brian's come up with.
I think the most iconic project in Dubai is the Burj Khalifa. It's a beautiful building, whether you see it from a distance or close to, and it's a unique shape, which is really a classic icon. The definition of an icon is a building that you can draw in under 3 seconds, preferably with one line, and I'd like to think that we've had our share of icons, possibly with Dubai Creek and some other projects.
3 seconds, one line.
Which has it's provoked something of a competition in the Business Breakfast studio this morning, hasn't it?
I think we've done all right, actually. We've done some of Dubai's big buildings, the Burj Khalifa, the Burj Al Arab. What else have we done? You've done the big building in Singapore.
I did the Marina Bay Sands with the three towers and the plinth across the top. Malcolm thought it was Stonehenge initially.
I had the paper upside down.
But it was. So people got that, and that was 3 seconds and one line. Chris Seymour, you just heard from Mott MacDonald. He did the
Kingdom Tower in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia.
Which was 3 seconds, but it was two lines, because to draw the whole you kind of needed to do two lines. But we've been sharing them on our Facebook page this morning. Producer Nonny has produced a gallery.
Have a crack, though. I think it's a really interesting definition, isn't it, really, of an iconic building. One you can draw in 3 seconds without taking your pencil off the page. I think it's a really good definition.
Oh, Producer Nonny's got them here. JJ, that is I hope that's not the Burj Khalifa, because it's leaning. It is?
The Leaning Burj.
The Leaning Burj Khalifa.
Leaning Tower of Burj.
Oh, that's the Burj Al Arab.
Yes,
from
that's good.
Producer Milani, that's good. That is producer Nonny, proud Australian.
Grand Mosque.
It's the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Sydney Harbour Bridge, Grand Mosque, doubling as.
That is the Kingdom Tower from Chris Seymour. Yeah. We've got others. Oh, they're still coming.
My goodness.
We love all of these.
I think it's a really good idea. What can you draw in 3 seconds?
That's a bunny rabbit.
It's a Churchill two fingers up, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
What is it? A producer Nonny's going to reveal what Serena's scribbled. I hesitate to use the word draw.
Apparently, it's the address hotel.
Right.
Really?
Okay.
Good old Serena, always off around the edge. Is that the Burj?
That's another Burj Al Arab, isn't it?
It's a new Sharif.
Many Burj Al Arabs coming in.
But anyway, it's a really interesting definition. Have a go yourself at home. And we also talked to Samaya Debach, the principal at Debach Architects and chair of the Riba Gulf chapter, on what she feels is iconic.
For me, the definition is for something that really had an impact on the way a city is being perceived globally. And I think really Burj Khalifa does that really well. It's not just a tallest building, but it's also created that whole downtown area that has become really popular and really changed the face of Dubai.
It really did change the face of Dubai. One of my favourite pieces of architecture is actually designed by Samaya. It's the Maliha Archaeological Centre out in Sharjah.
Yeah, you've always been a big fan of that, haven't you?
It's just a beautiful building in a beautiful setting. And it's great. It's only about 2 stories high. There's a kind of sweeping driveway from the top to the bottom. And my kids like going down there on the scooters. I probably shouldn't let them as a responsible parent, but it is darn good fun.
So there's also good stuff up in Abu Dhabi as well. I think the Louvre is an interesting piece of architecture. Whether you can draw that in 3 seconds with one line, I'm not sure.
I think it would look like a flying saucer roundabout in Sharjah from days gone by if I did. It would be indistinguishable.
But the Grand Mosque certainly is iconic, isn't it, really? Once you start drawing clock towers, it all becomes a bit more complicated.
Yeah, I got your Big Ben earlier on.
Yeah, you did get Big Ben in the Houses of Commons. What was the other one I did for you? Oh, the Sydney
Opera House.
Yeah, that's quite good.
Yes.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
The head of investment strategy at Barclays Private Bank, Henk Potts, with us in the studio. Let's get straight down to basics. Where should we be investing our money ahead of 2020? Because when I look at global stock market, yeah, I think, blimey, they look a bit frothy and toppy. The US seems to be at a record pretty much every day. And yet, you say investors should maintain their exposure to equities in 2020. I put it to you, sir, that equities are a bubble waiting to burst.
I don't know if they're a bubble waiting to burst. I think investors should maintain their composure. I think you're quite right. Listen, we've seen a strong performance from equity markets, particularly the S&P 500 during the course of this year, up 24%. So it really depends, of course, as always, in terms of your time horizon. If you've got a relatively short-term time horizon, then I think you need to make sure that you've got some protection involved in your equity market exposure. Long-term, it always comes down to diversification. So they're going to be some important components, I think, as you look out to next year. I think the global economy is in reasonable shape. We'll see a steady but probably uninspiring growth as you look out to next year, maybe slightly better than we've seen during the course of this year. Central banks still remain very accommodative. The corporate picture is reasonably bright, but when you look at markets, I agree with you, they're almost priced to perfection. They believe a trade deal is going to happen, that central banks will continue to be very supportive, that fiscal stimulus will come through, that companies' earnings will meet analysts' expectations. If they don't achieve that, then there's a potential for some weakness, at least in the short term.
So in terms of geographies, let's say I buy your thesis on buying equities, even though I'm nervous.
So you already turned around. I like it. This is good news.
But which equities do I buy? I know you're not going to give stock-specific recommendations, buy Amazon, sell Apple. But in terms, very simply, in terms of geographies and continents, where do you like and where do you like less?
I still think the US is an important area to invest in. The US is the most dynamic economy in the world. It's the most efficient user of capital. There's such an intense focus on shareholder return. We think US growth will be somewhere around 2.3% during the course of this year, maybe slow to somewhere between 1.6 and 1.8% as you look out to next year. What is underpinning that growth continues to be the US consumer. Remember, they're in great shape today. US unemployment is very low. 3.6% is nearly the lowest that we've seen in 50 years. That compares to October 2009, when unemployment, remember, was at 10%. We think unemployment will continue to remain low as you look through the course of 2020. Pay growth is less you'd expect at this point in the economic cycle, but it's running faster than inflation. Tax cuts have boosted disposable income.
We've been talking gold this morning with our gold expert, Jeff Rhodes, and he was saying that, you know, the price of gold is going to go up. But, of course, the safe haven status that everyone's running to at the moment could be taken away if there's an immediate trade settlement with China and if other global issues in the States and things sort themselves out in the near future. What's your view on that?
Exactly. It comes down to the balance a little bit, I think, that we're talking about. So you maintain the exposure to risk assets, to equity markets, developed market equities, an element of emerging markets. But you need to offset some of that risk, that diversification. And gold is certainly one of the tools that would look for that.
What else would you use as well as gold?
Cash, short-dated bonds is probably the other example that you could use for that. But gold has been a good performer during the course of this year, up around 13, 14%. That's benefited from lower global rates and, of course, nervous investors. Lower rates reduces the opportunity cost of holding a zero interest-bearing asset. And alongside that, we've seen strong flows into exchange-traded funds. And gold will continue to be supported, I think, by central bank purchases. So gold is seen as a safe haven asset. No fundamental reason why that's the case, but maybe if enough people believe it, starts to generate its own truth. But it's really seen as a diversification tool to us.
Where do you stand on the new markets of cryptocurrencies?
We remain very cautious about the prospects for cryptocurrencies. As a currency, I don't think they fulfill the title. They've not been a storer of value. As a medium exchange, I think it's very weak. There's still an awful lot of places that wouldn't accept cryptocurrencies. As an investment, I think it's very difficult from that perspective. The reality is, an investor, you have to deal with outsized volatility. You have to deal with lack of security. And, of course, you should remember, it's very difficult to value these. The reality is they don't generate cash flow. They don't pay a dividend. They don't pay a coupon. There's no central bank or government that stands behind it. So I think we'd be very cautious about that. For clients, we believe in the technology behind it. Blockchain is an important development, and we'd be focusing more on that.
Let's talk about some markets close to where we're sitting now. The Middle East markets, lots of interesting stuff happening, in particular in Saudi Arabia. And also one of the world's biggest emerging markets, just a two-hour flight away, is India.
Yeah, so I think obviously oil is going to be an important component of that when it comes to the local markets, particularly looking at Saudi Arabia. The oil price has been pushed up, as we know, on the back of tensions in the Middle East, reduced production levels coming from the likes of Libya and from Venezuela, the impact of the US sanctions on Iran. So, and alongside that, the expectation that we'll see OPEC continuing to maintain the reduction in output as you look through the course of 2020. But also, we should remember, supply from the United States has been rising quite dramatically. We think the US will produce a record 13 million barrels of oil per day during the course of next year. And demand growth expectation has been falling a little bit on the back of the weaker growth that we've been seeing. So we think that crude prices, or Brent, will average $62 a barrel as you look out to next year. To answer your second question around India, India, I think, has underperformed its potential over the course of the past few decades, given its huge scale, its potential for a very attractive and vibrant domestic economy. Narendra Modi, as we know, has been turning that around. He's been fighting corruption. He's been overhauling the tax system. He's been trying to encourage international investors back into the economy. But there's still an awful lot of work to be done around things like financial inclusion, the Made in India campaign, trying to revitalize domestic manufacturing and faster urbanization, along with labor laws and property laws that need to be, I think, changed quite substantially. India's growth pretty poor during the course of this year, somewhere around 5.3%. We think it starts to recover as you look out to next year. We've got growth of 7.4%.
Hank, we'll have to leave it there. Great talking to you. Director Investment Strategy at the Private Bank of Barclays, Hank Potts. Been a pleasure.
Pleasure.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Richard, you and I both enjoyed the air show last week. For me, what jumped out was the amount of drones and non-human flight, if you like, the future of aviation. But I also wandered into a standalone climate-controlled shed at the Dubai Air Show last week to get a glimpse of aviation after the end of hydrocarbon-powered flight. Here's what I observed and what I learnt.
We're sitting looking at the brand new PAV, the passenger air vehicle of the future. And to describe it very briefly, it's on runners, almost like a float plane. It's got 8 propellers on the floats and lots of interesting stuff stuck on the wings. But it looks like the size of a very small plane. I mean, it looks like a traditional plane with bits stuck on it. How different is it?
Well, the design is actually, it's a fully autonomous, fully electric vehicle. And so it's a prototype looking at the various systems, the avionics, the battery power that we would look to build a future, you know, private aircraft, maybe an air taxi.
It hasn't got wheels. It's on stands. And I know this is experimental. Is that the way it's going to stay?
Absolutely not. No, this is very early in design. We'll actually be continuing our flight testing into early next year so we can continue to learn from the flight testing and then also look at, would we look at a four-passenger variant, looking at a hybrid variant, also looking at the battery power. So all those things will be looked at to what it would ultimately look like in the future.
I mean, the one that we're looking at the moment is not particularly small. How many passengers would that take?
That's currently designed for two.
It's quite a big aircraft just to take two people around.
It is. You know, it has to have the mobility with the wingspan as well as the battery and other things. But as I said, it's a very early prototype, so we'll be looking to change it up appropriately.
In some ways, it looks a bit like a drone because the propellers are facing upwards rather than forwards on the wings. They're on the floaty bits at the bottom. Does it behave like a plane? Is it going to land in the traditional way at an airport, even if it's vertical takeoff landing?
It's an eVTOL, so it's an electric vertical takeoff and landing. So you use those rotors, as you mentioned, to vertically take off, and then the propeller would then kick in to then glide on the wing. So it would propel forward and then land on the vertical.
Yeah. The big difference with this, of course, is that it's moving away from hydrocarbons. Mm-hmm. What's the story?
Well, I mean, absolutely, as we're looking at the future of mobility, the environmental impact of our products is top of mind. And so looking at electric power is certainly important as we look at reducing our environmental footprint.
So what does this take to drive it? Well, how is it powered?
Right now, it's fully electric.
We know that the batteries that go into electric cars, for instance, are so expensive that they're making the cars themselves prohibitively expensive as well. They'll come down eventually. But is this one of those sort of experimental vehicles that probably won't see production simply because it's prohibitively expensive?
Well, I mean, the production would be mandated by certainly certification. And so certainly the aircraft is an element, but really what we're looking at is the ecosystem with which these vehicles will operate. That's really the most important aspect. How do we safely integrate a autonomous vehicle with a piloted vehicle and creating a safe airspace for that to take place.
How do these batteries get their power? Where do they get charged from?
Well, that would be something we'd be looking at as we start to look at the operationalizing it, as far as would we, you know, charge and replace. You know, that would be some of the things we'd be looking at.
Is it possible to have solar, or does it have to be a hydrocarbon power that's powering those batteries?
Yeah, we've had the question before. We have another aircraft called Odysseus that is solar powered. So, I mean, that's certainly something to look at. A hybrid variant is also something we're looking at. So, as we start to look at distance and mobility, a hybrid would probably be more feasible as far as getting range.
The advantage of putting two people in a plane, presumably, is to make it function like a taxi. Really, where do they land? I mean, it's too big to go onto most building rooftops. So where do you see them landing?
Well, I mean, so as we start to look at that ecosystem, you would start to think of landing ports. Also, it could be on rooftops, things of that nature. Certainly, we look at what would be the use case as far as getting people quickly to an airport to make a larger flight. So that would be how we start looking at that ecosystem environment of where people would get in and out.
We hear one of the drawbacks to people buying electric cars is range anxiety, the worry about the battery power running out when you're halfway through a journey. But if that's bad in a car, you can imagine how much worse it would be in a plane. I mean, how are you addressing that in the early stages?
Well, so right now it's really just testing. So right now we're looking at the avionics, the infrastructure, all those things have to come together to ultimately create a space where they could operate safely. Those are all questions that we're looking at now.
Because as you add batteries, of course, it gets heavier, and then you need more engines.
Absolutely.
And more wind sprang. What sort of time do you think that ideally it will be able to fly?
It's a great question. I mean, certainly something we're looking at. I could conceivably see something happening within the next decade. In addition to the passenger air vehicle that you're looking at right now, we also are looking at a cargo air vehicle, so one that would move and transport goods and supplies.
Mile delivery.
Exactly. So last mile delivery. We're doing testing on a vehicle similar to PAV, the cargo air vehicle. That testing is ongoing now as well.
Good luck. Thanks very much indeed for talking to us about the plane, and we look forward to being invited up with it at some point in the future.
Would love to have you. Thank you.
Thanks.
That's the guys from Boeing talking about their post-hydrocarbon-powered flight. We're back tomorrow morning, live on air, with the Business Breakfast Breakfast from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.